This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batts with Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. 2027. That is a year mentioned again and again as a possible jump for the People's Liberation Army Navy against Taiwan. But more than that, the first island chain, the second island chain, the third island chain. Gordon and I welcome our colleague, Professor James Holmes of the U.S. Naval War College, to help us understand the latest headlines from the U.S. Navy in preparation for 2027. Navy leaders look to expand munitions options as supplies run low. Navy leaders are looking for brand new types of munitions. During testimony before the House Appropriations Committee, Acting Chief of Naval Operations Admiral James Kilby acknowledged recent operations in the Red Sea have highlighted the strain on our munitions industrial base. Professor, a very good evening to you. Please translate this. What are they talking about? They're low on ammo, is that it? Or they have the wrong kind of ammo? Good evening.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both. It's mostly a matter of quantity, as you point out. I mean, if we had a lot of SM-6s, I mean, these super effective surface-to-air and air-to-air missiles, I mean, that would be wonderful, obviously, because they give us range, they give us precision, they give us all this. I mean, they give us all this capability, but they are very, very pricey in the case of the SM-6, in upwards of $4 million a shot. I mean, that's a huge amount that you're talking about spending. But even more than the cost, it's simply a matter that these are very complicated and delicate machinery. It takes a long time to manufacture them in bulk. So the services, not only the Navy, but also our fellow services, are looking around for not only new manufacturers, but new types of munitions that can do the job, especially against drones, at a much more reasonable cost. That usually comes at an expense in terms of range and so forth. But there are good things happening, whether it's counter-drone drones or the one that's really stood out to me in recent weeks, come out of the U.S. Air Force, where they've taken to repurposing air-to-ground rockets, 70-millimeter rockets, as counter-drones, sort of air-to-air counter-drone munitions. They can put 14 of those things on one pile on one F-16, and that really multiplies the engagement opportunities for the Air Force. And the Navy's been in the same business as well. We're also doing the same thing with platforms. We're looking for new types of ships and so forth, and that requires reaching out to new shipbuilders and trying to figure out what the future fleet looks like.
Gordon, you have a question for the professor.
Jim, you mentioned drones. There are these images of China's aircraft carrier in the skies carrying hundreds of drones. I mean, is that real? And do we have anything similar?
I mean, yes, it is real. I think. I mean, you hear the intelligence reporting and so forth, so it does feel like that. And by the way, Iran's trying to do something on a much lower level as well, as far as a drone carrier. Don't think that one's going to be nearly as impressive as what China can do. But we are certainly not going over to an all drone air wing on any of our carriers, whether it's our nuclear powered aircraft carriers or our amphibs or any of those things. But by the same token, every ship in a sense is going to be at least a low grade drone carrier pretty soon. The Navy's already outfitting escort ships with counter drone drones so that they can not only protect themselves but also protect the carrier more effectively. There are things like loitering munitions out there that you can actually put in the sky if you're expecting an attack, and they can sort of wait around and intercept threats as they come in. And some of them you can actually recover, refuel, and reuse, which is kind of a neat technology in the making as well, and something that seems to be being fielded right now.
China's got the threat. However, the article pointing to Admiral Kilby's testimony talks about how much was expended in the Red Sea against the Houthis to very little gain, as far as I read from the media afterwards. That air campaign is halted or paused right now. So are we looking at the U.S. Navy disciplining itself using these high-tech methods against what you'd have to say is at best a guerrilla force, certainly nothing organized on the scale of the U.S. Navy?
Yeah, well, I mean, President Trump announced that the Houthis is basically not sued for peace, but at least agreed to a ceasefire. I think that's I think that's a bit misleading, simply because the Houthis immediately after they've stopped attacking shipping in the Red Sea, but they were very upfront about continuing attacks on Israel, which is the major thrust of that campaign, is to show solidarity with Gaza and so forth. So that's it's on the Houthis. I don't think you can argue that that was a decisive air campaign, although it may have decided the Houthis in favor of shutting down one arm of that air campaign. And that sort of seems to be where we stand right now. As far as the Navy disciplining itself, yeah, I think the answer is yes. I mean, and that brings us back to cost and munitions types and so forth. We do have other engagement opportunities against anti-ship crews and ballistic missiles and drones and so forth. But those generally, again, if you're using a cheaper munition, chances are you're sacrificing capability for lower cost, and therefore you probably have to let those threats get closer in, and thus increase their probability of actually hitting one of our ships. So there's always going to be trade-offs among cost, among munitions, and among risk when you're doing this sort of thing. Obviously, China is going to present an order of magnitude greater challenge if we get in a scrap with them in the Western Pacific, if a 6 or 8 power like the Houthis can actually do what they've done.
The estimate is $1 billion in weapons in a 5-week campaign with an unclear conclusion. Gordon, you have a question.
So what can the Navy do? I mean, it seems like you have a $20,000 drone, but you need $1 million missile to take it down. I mean, clearly this is unsustainable, and clearly this says that the attackers will eventually win because they can build drones faster than we can build missiles. So what is the Navy going to do?
Well, I mean, all the way back to the Biden administration, the Navy under the supervision of our former Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks has been doing something they're calling the Replicator Initiative, which is an initiative to field by 2027, which is supposedly the year of crisis, thousands upon thousands of low cost unmanned technologies, drones, and so forth. So there's certainly a recognition that we need to do this. And like I said, there are possibilities out there for. Especially for counter drone warfare. Drones are not intrinsically difficult to shoot down. There's simply a lot of them out there, so you need to be the ability to do this. But again, so there's a lot of experimentation with different things, because you're right, the cost exchange ratio is just not sustainable. But again, especially simply because it takes so long to manufacture an advanced missile. It's almost like manufacturing an aircraft, basically an advanced aircraft. It just takes time. So that's sort of where we are. Again, munitions, lower cost munitions can be repurposed in some circumstances at lower costs to try to even that cost exchange ratio out to something less forbidding.
Jim, the first island, second island, third island chain I mentioned in our opening remarks, is that still part of the Navy thinking for 2027? And is it ready to fall back if it comes to the Taiwan and the Philippines being overrun in the first days?
Well, I mean, you have to think about the nature of the war. Yes, the island chains are a permanent construct in Chinese thinking about maritime warfare in the Western Pacific, and therefore we have to take that seriously. The first island chain, of course, extending from Japan through Taiwan and on down through the Philippines to the Malacca Strait. Second island chain from northern Japan down through New Guinea via our base at Guam. And the third island chain is one that's, you don't hear too much about it, but some Chinese do talk about a third island chain, which is Hawaii looping down towards Fiji and Samoa, which is, I mean, that's very, very far from China and relatively close to the United States. So it's, but yeah, these geographic features in Chinese perceptions that they look like concentric U.S. defenses encircling China and hampering its maritime destiny. So that's so there's the geographic and the perceptual aspect. As far as whether we are willing to fall back, the answer is no. I mean, that's the, now, I mean, it's always possible the Chinese could evict us from the region, but really the core of U.S. military strategy as it's shaping up right now is to be stubborn, not be driven out of the Western Pacific the way we were in 1941 and 1942. That's what the U.S. Marines mean when they talk about stand-in forces. That means forces that stubbornly remain within the first island chain. Chiefly the first island chain, they remain mobile, they remain elusive, and so forth, and they dish out punishment against Chinese ships and aircraft along the first island chain. So in essence, we are announcing that we will stand in rather than stand off. at the outside of a conflict. And we put the Chinese on notice that they simply will not get a short war. It will be a long, bloody conflict, and therefore, and obviously a long conflict is going to be not only costly and dangerous, but also risky in terms of China fulfilling its aims, and really the Chinese Communist Party, its ability to reign in power should it lose a conflict.
Jim, if the Chinese penetrate the first island chain, do they believe that they can attack all the way to the American homeland?
You don't really get the sense that I mean, they don't really talk about it. I think they're more just concerned with getting into the Western Pacific. I mean, if you think about it, everything that China wants to accomplish in the world really depends on access to the Western Pacific and points beyond. If they can burst through the first island chain, whether by taking Taiwan or by some other method, at that point they've assured their ability to get out into the Western Pacific. And I think they obviously would like to control all the way out to the second island chain, so about 1,500 nautical miles off of China's coast. But you don't really get the sense that they intend to go on the offensive and bring the war all the way to the west coast of the U.S. or Hawaii or whatever the case may be. I will say, I mean, it's possible you could argue that there's a subtext there. Certainly, U.S. leaders, military and political leaders, all the way back to the 1950s, have argued that losing Taiwan, losing the first island chain, does expose the United States to a direct attack from the Soviet bloc back in those days. And you can make the same logic with China today. So,
Jim Holmes, U.S. Naval War College, Gordon Chang.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.